But when he heard another officer talking about swinging by the courthouse, he interceded. "I'm headed out that way," he'd said. "I'll do it for you." In truth, he hadn't been heading toward the courthouse, at least not until he'd volunteered, and he wasn't such a Samaritan that he'd drive 40 miles out of the goodness of his heart. Patrick wanted to go there for one reason only. It was another excuse to see Alex Cormier. He pulled into an empty spot and got out of his car, immediately spotting her Honda. This was a good thing. For all he knew, she might not even have been in court today. But then he did a double take as he realized that someone was in the car, and that that someone was the judge. She wasn't moving, just staring out the windshield. The wipers were on, but it wasn't raining. It looked like she didn't even realize she was crying. He felt that same uneasy sway in the pit of his stomach that usually came when he'd reached a crime scene and saw a victim's tears. "I'm too late," he thought. "Again." Patrick approached the car, but the judge must not have seen him coming. When he knocked on the window, she jumped a foot and hurriedly wiped her eyes. He mimed for her to roll down the window. "Everything okay?" he asked.
"I'm fine."
"You don't look fine."
"Then stop looking," she snapped.
He hooked his fingers over the curl of the car door.
"Listen, you want to go somewhere and talk? I'll buy you coffee."
The judge sighed.
"You can't buy me coffee."
"Well, we can still get some."
He stood up and walked around to the passenger door, opened it, slid into the seat beside her.
"You're on duty," she pointed out.
"I'm taking my lunch break."
"At 10 in the morning?"
He reached across the console to the keys, dangling in the ignition, and started the car.
"Head out of the parking lot and take a left, all right?"
"Or what?"
"For God's sake, don't you know better than to argue with someone who's wearing a Glock?"
She looked at him for a long moment.
"You couldn't possibly be carjacking me," the judge said, but she started driving, as he'd asked.
"Remind me to arrest myself later," Patrick said.
Alex had been raised by her father to give everything her best shot, and apparently that included falling off the deep end. Why not recuse herself from the biggest trial of her career, ask for administrative leave, and go out for coffee with the detective on the case all in one fell swoop? Then again, she told herself, if she hadn't gone out with Patrick Ducharme, she would never have known that the Golden Dragon Chinese restaurant opened for business at 10 a.m. If she hadn't gone out with him, she would have had to drive home and start her life over. Everyone at the restaurant seemed to know the detective and didn't mind him going into the kitchen to get Alex her cup of coffee.
"What you saw back there," Alex said hesitantly, "you won't
tell anyone you were having a little breakdown in your car?"
She looked down at the mug he set in front of her, not even really knowing how to respond. In her experience, the moment you showed you were weak in front of someone, they'd use it against you.
"It's hard to be a judge sometimes. People expect you to act like one, even when you've got the flu and feel like crawling up into a ball and dying, or cursing out the cashier who shortchanged you on purpose. There's not a lot of room for mistakes."
"Your secret's safe," Patrick said. "I won't tell anyone in the law enforcement community that you've actually got emotions."
Alex took a sip of the coffee, then looked up at him.
"Sugar?"
Patrick folded his arms on the bar and leaned toward her.
"Darling."
At her expression, he started to laugh and then handed her the bowl.
"Honestly, it's no big deal. We all have lousy days at work."
"Do you sit in your car and cry?"
"Not recently, but I have been known to overturn evidence lockers during fits of frustration."
He poured milk into a creamer and set it down.
"You know,
It's not mutually exclusive.
What's not?
Being a judge and being human.
Alex added the milk to her mug.
Tell that to everyone who wants me to recuse myself. Isn't this the part where you tell me we can't talk about the case?
Yes, Alex said. Except I'm not on the case anymore. As of noon, it'll be public knowledge.
He sobered. Is that why you were upset?
No, I'd already made the decision to leave the case, but then I got word that Josie's on the witness list for the defense.
Why? Patrick said. She doesn't remember anything. What could she possibly say?
I don't know. Alex glanced up. But what if it's my fault? What if the lawyer only did that to get me off the case because I was too stubborn to recuse myself when the issue was first raised? To her great shame, she realized she was starting to cry again, and she stared down at the bar in the hope that Patrick wouldn't notice. What if she has to get up in front of everyone in court and relive that whole day? Patrick passed her a cocktail napkin, and she wiped her eyes.
I'm sorry. I'm not usually like this.
Any mother whose daughter came that close to dying has a right to fall apart at the seams, Patrick said. Look, I've talked to Josie twice. I know her statement back and forth. It doesn't matter if McAfee puts her on the stand. There's nothing she can say that's going to hurt her. The silver lining is that now you don't have to worry about a conflict of interest. Josie needs a good mother right now more than she needs a good judge.
Alex smiled ruefully. What a shame she's stuck with me instead.
Come on.
It's true. My whole life with Josie has been a series of disconnects.
Well, Patrick pointed out, that presumes that at one point you were connected.
Neither of us remembers back that far. You've had better conversations with Josie than I have lately.
Alex stared into the mug of coffee.
Everything I say to Josie comes out wrong. She looks at me like I'm from another planet. Like I have no right to act like a concerned parent now because I wasn't acting like one before it happened.
Why weren't you?
I was working. Hard, Alex said.
Lots of parents work hard.
But I'm good at being a judge and lousy at being a mother.
Alex covered her mouth with her hand, but it was too late to take back the truth, which coiled on the bar in front of her, poisonous. What had she been thinking, confessing that to someone when she could barely admit it to herself? She might as well have drawn a bullseye on her Achilles heel.
Maybe you should try talking to Josie the way you talk to the people who come into your court, then,
Patrick suggested.
She hates it when I act like a lawyer. Besides, I hardly talk in court. Mostly, I listen.
Well, Your Honor, Patrick said, that might work, too. Once, when Josie had been a baby, Alex let her out of her sight long enough for Josie to climb up on a stool. From across the room, Alex watched in terror as Josie's slight weight upset the balance. She couldn't get there fast enough to keep Josie from falling. She didn't want to yell out because she was afraid that if she startled Josie, that would make her fall too. So Alex had stood, waiting for an accident to happen. But instead, Josie managed to perch herself on the stool, to stand up on its little disc seat, to reach the light switch she'd been heading for all along. Alex watched her flick the lights on and off, watched her face split with a smile every time she realized that her actions could transform the world.
"Since we're not in court," she said hesitantly, "I'd like it if you called me Alex."
Patrick smiled. "And I'd like it if you called me Your Majesty King Kamehameha."
Alex couldn't help herself. She laughed.
But if that's too hard to remember, Patrick would be fine.
He reached for the coffee pot and poured some into her mug.
"Free refills," he said. She watched him add sugar and cream in the same quantities that she'd used for her first cup. He was a detective. His job was to notice details. But Alex thought that probably wasn't what made him such a good cop. It was that he had the capacity to use force, like any other police officer, but instead, he'd trap you with kindness. That, Alex knew, was always more deadly. It wasn't something he'd put on his resume, but Jordan was especially gifted at cutting the rug to Wiggles songs. His personal favorite was Hot Potato, but the one that really got Sam jazzed up was Fruit Salad. While Selena was upstairs taking a hot bath, Jordan put on the DVD. She was opposed to bombarding Sam with media and didn't want him to be able to spell Dorothy, as in dinosaur, before he could even write his own name. Selena always wanted Jordan to be doing something else with the baby, like memorizing Shakespeare or solving differential equations. But Jordan was a big believer in letting the television do its job in turning one's brain into porridge, at least long enough to get one good, silly tango session out of it. Babies were always just the right weight, so that when you finally put them down, you felt like something was missing. "Fruit salad, yummy, yummy," Jordan crooned, whirling around until Sam opened his mouth and let a peal of giggles ribbon out. The doorbell rang, and Jordan sashayed himself and his tiny partner through the entryway to answer it. Harmonizing, sort of, with Jeff, Murray, Greg, and Anthony in the background, Jordan opened the door. "Let's make some fruit salad today," he sang, and then he saw who was standing on his porch. "Judge Cormier!" "Sorry to interrupt." He already knew that she'd recused herself from the case. That happy announcement had been passed down this afternoon. "No, that's fine. Come on in." Jordan glanced back at the trail of toys that he and Sam had left in their wake. He had to clean those up before Selena came back downstairs, too. Kicking as many as he could behind the couch, he led the judge into his living room and switched off the DVD. "This must be your son."
"Yeah."
Jordan looked down at the baby, who was in the process of deciding whether or not to throw a fit now that the music had been turned off.
"Sam."
She reached out, letting Sam curl his hand around her forefinger. Sam could charm the pants off Hitler, probably, but seeing him only seemed to make Judge Cormier more agitated. "Why did you put my daughter on your witness list?"
"Ah."
"Because," Jordan said, "Josie and Peter used to be friends, and I may need her as a character witness."
"They were friends 10 years ago. Be honest, you did this to get me off the case."
Jordan hefted Sam higher on his hip.
"Your Honor, with all due respect, I'm not going to allow anyone to try this case for me, especially not a judge who isn't even involved in it anymore."
He watched something flare behind her eyes.
"Of course not," she said tightly,
and then she turned on her heel and walked out. Ask a random kid today if she wants to be popular, and she'll tell you no, even if the truth is that if she was in a desert dying of thirst and had the choice between a glass of water and instant popularity, she'd probably choose the latter. As soon as she heard the knock, Josie took her notebook and shoved it between the mattress and the box spring, which had to be the world's lamest hiding spot. Her mother stepped inside the bedroom, and for a second, Josie couldn't put her finger on what wasn't quite right. Then she figured it out. It wasn't dark out yet. Usually by the time her mother got home from court, it was dinner time. But now it was only 3:45. Josie had barely gotten home from school.
"I have to talk to you," her mother said, sitting down beside her on the comforter. "I took myself off the case today."
Josie stared at her. In her whole life, she'd never known her mother to back down from any legal challenge. Plus, hadn't they just had a conversation about the fact that she wasn't recusing herself? She felt that sick sinking that came when the teacher called on her and she hadn't been paying attention. What had her mother found out that she hadn't known days ago?
What happened?
Josie asked, and she hoped her mother wasn't paying attention enough to hear the way her voice was jumping all over the place.
Well, that's the other thing I need to talk to you about, her mother said. The defense put you on their witness list. They may ask you to go to court.
What? Josie cried, and for just one moment, everything stopped. Her breath, her heart, her courage.
I can't go to court, Mom, she said. Don't make me. Please.
Her mother reached out for her, which was a good thing, because Josie was certain that at any second she was going to simply vanish. Sublimation, she thought, the act of going from solid to vapor. And then she realized that this term was one she'd studied for the science test she'd never had because of everything else that had happened.
I've been talking to the detective, and I know you don't remember anything. The only reason you're even on that list is because you used to be friends with Peter a long, long time ago.
Josie drew back.
Do you swear that I won't have to go to court?
Her mother hesitated.
Honey, I can't. You have to.
What if we go talk to the defense attorney? Her mother said.
What good would that do?
Well, if he sees how upset this is making you, he might think twice about using you as a witness at all. Josie lay down on her bed. For a few moments, her mother stroked her hair. Josie thought she heard her whisper, "I'm sorry." And then she got up and closed the door behind her.
Matt,
Josie whispered, as if he could hear her, as if he could answer.
Matt.
She drew in his name like oxygen and imagined it breaking into 1,000 tiny pieces, funneling into her red blood cells, beating through her heart. Peter snapped a pencil in half and stuck the eraser end into his cornbread.
Happy birthday to me,
he sang under his breath. He didn't finish the song. What was the point when you already knew where it was heading? Hey, Oten, a correctional officer said. We got a present for you. Standing behind him was a kid not much older than Peter. He was rocking back and forth on the balls of his feet, and he had snot running down his nose. The officer led him into the cell.
Make sure you share your cake, the officer said.
Peter sat down on the lower bunk, just to let this kid know exactly who was in charge. The boy stood with his arms crossed tight around the blanket he'd been given, staring down at the ground. He reached up and pushed his glasses up his nose, and that's when Peter realized there was something, well, wrong with him. He had that glassy-eyed, gum-lipped look of a special needs kid. Peter realized why they'd stuck the kid in his cell instead of anyone else's. They figured Peter would be least likely to fuck with him. He felt his hands ball into fists.
Hey, you, Peter said.
The boy swiveled his head toward Peter.
I have a dog, he said. Do you have a dog?
Peter pictured the correctional officers watching this comedy through their little video hookups, expecting Peter to put up with this shit. Expecting something of him, period. He reached forward and plucked the glasses off the kid's nose. They were Coke bottle thick, with black plastic frames. The boy started to shriek, grabbing at his own face. His scream sounded like an air horn. Peter put the glasses down on the floor and stomped on them, but in his rubber flip-flops that didn't do much damage. So he picked them up and smashed them into the bars of the cell until the glass shattered. By then the officers had arrived to pull Peter away from the kid. Not that he was touching him, anyway. They handcuffed him as the other inmates cheered him on. He was dragged down the hall to the superintendent's office. He sat hunched in a chair, with a guard watching him breathe, until the superintendent came in.
What was that all about, Peter?
It's my birthday, Peter said. I just wanted to be alone for it.
The funny thing, he realized, was that before the shooting, he'd believed that the best thing in the world was being left alone, so nobody could tell him he didn't fit in. But as it turned out, not that he was about to tell the superintendent this, he didn't much like himself either. The superintendent started to talk about disciplinary action, how this could affect him in the event of a conviction, what few privileges were left to be taken away. Peter deliberately tuned him out. He thought instead of how angry the rest of the pod would be when this incident cost them television for a week. He thought of Jordan's bullied victim syndrome and wondered if he believed it, if anyone would. He thought of how nobody who saw him in jail, not his mother, not his lawyer, ever said what they should, that Peter would be imprisoned forever, that he'd die in a cell that looked just like this one. He thought of how he would rather end his life with a bullet. He thought of how at night you could hear the wings of bats beating in the cement corners of the jail, and screams. No one was stupid enough to cry. At 9 a.m. on Saturday, when Jordan opened the door, he was still wearing pajama bottoms.
You've got to be kidding, he said.
Judge Cormier pasted on a smile. I'm really sorry we got off on the wrong foot, she said, but you know how it is when it's your child who's in trouble. You just can't think straight. She stood arm in arm with the mini-me standing beside her. Josie Cormier, Jordan thought, scrutinizing the girl who was shaking like an aspen leaf. She had chestnut hair that hit her shoulders and blue eyes that wouldn't meet his.
Josie is really scared, the judge said. I wondered if we could sit down for a minute. Maybe you could put her at ease about being a witness. Hear whether or not what she knows will even help your case. Jordan, who is it?
He turned around to find Selena standing in the entryway, holding on to Sam. She was wearing flannel pajamas, which might or might not have been one step more formal. Judge Cormier was wondering if we could talk to Josie about her testimony, he said pointedly, trying desperately to telegraph to Selena that he was in deep trouble, since they all knew, with the exception perhaps of Josie, that the only reason he'd noticed up his intent to use her was to get Cormier off the case. Jordan turned toward the judge again.
You see, I'm not really at that stage of planning yet.
Surely you have some idea of what you're after if you call her as a witness, or you wouldn't have put her on the list, Alex pointed out.
Why don't you ring my secretary and make an appointment?
I was thinking of now, Judge Cormier said. Please, I'm not here as a judge, just as a mother.
Selena stepped forward.
You come right on in, she said, using her free arm to circle Josie's shoulders. You must be Josie, right? This here's Sam.
Josie smiled shyly at the baby.
Hi, Sam.
Baby, why don't you get the judge some coffee or juice? Jordan stared at his wife, wondering what the hell she was up to now.
Right. Why don't you come on in?
Thankfully, the house looked nothing like it had the first time Cormier had showed up unannounced. There were no dishes in the sink, no papers cluttered the tables, toys were mysteriously missing. What could Jordan say? His wife was a neat freak. He pulled out one of the chairs at the kitchen table and offered it to Josie, then did the same for the judge.
How do you take your coffee? He asked.
Oh, we're fine, she said.
She reached under the table for her daughter's hand.
Sam and I, we're just going into the living room to play, Selena said.
Why don't you stay?
He gave her a measured glance, one that begged her not to leave him alone to be eviscerated.
You don't need us distracting you, Selena said, and she took the baby away.
Jordan sat down heavily across from the Cormiers. He was good at thinking on his feet, Surely he could suffer through this. Well, he said, it really isn't anything to be scared of at all. I was just going to ask you some basic questions about your friendship with Peter.
We're not friends, Josie said.
Yes, I know that, but you used to be. I'm interested in the first time you met him.
Josie glanced at Alex. Around nursery school, or maybe before.
Okay. Did you play at your house? His?
Both.
Did you have other friends who used to hang out with you?
Not really, Josie said.
Alex listened, but she couldn't help tuning a lawyer's ear to McAfee's questions. He's got nothing, she thought. This is nothing. When did you two stop hanging around?
Sixth grade, Josie answered. We just kind of started liking different things.
Did you have any contact with Peter after that? Josie shifted in her chair.
Only in the halls and stuff.
You worked with him too, right? Josie looked at her mother again.
Not for very long.
Both mother and daughter stared at him, anticipatory, which was awfully funny, because Jordan was making this all up as he went. What about the relationship between Matt and Peter?
They didn't have one, Josie said,
but her cheeks went pink. Did Matt do anything to Peter that might have been upsetting?
Maybe.
Can you be more specific? She shook her head, her lips pressed tightly together. When was the last time you saw Matt and Peter together?
I don't remember,
Josie whispered. Did they fight? Tears clouded her eyes.
I don't know.
She turned to her mother and then slowly sank her head down to the table, her face pressed into the curve of her own arm.
Honey, why don't you go wait in the other room? The judge said evenly.
They both watched Josie sit down on a chair in the living room, wiping her eyes, hunching forward to watch the baby playing on the floor.
Look, Judge Cormier sighed. I'm off the case. I know that's why you put her on the witness list, even if you'd never actually intended to call her. But I'm not questioning that right now. I'm talking to you parent to parent. If I give you an affidavit signed by Josie saying she doesn't remember anything, would you think twice about putting her on the stand?
Jordan glanced into the living room. Selena had coaxed Josie onto the floor with her. She was pushing a toy plane toward Sam's feet. When he burst out with the sheer belly laugh that only a baby has, Josie smiled the tiniest bit, too. Selena caught his gaze, raised her brows in a question. He'd gotten what he wanted, Cormier's recusal. He could be generous enough to do this for her. All right, he told the judge. Get me the affidavit. When they say to scald the milk, Josie said, scrubbing another Brillo pad against the blackened bottom of the pot, I don't think they mean like this. Her mother picked up a dish towel.
Well, how was I supposed to know?
Maybe we should start with something easier than pudding, Josie suggested.
Like?
She smiled.
Toast?
Now that her mother was home during the day, she was restless. To that end, she'd taken up cooking, which was a good idea only if you happened to work for the fire department and needed job security. Even when her mother followed the recipe, it didn't turn out the way it was supposed to. And then inevitably Josie would press her for the details and find out she'd used baking powder instead of baking soda or whole wheat flour instead of cornmeal.
We didn't have any, she complained.
At first, Josie had suggested nightly culinary classes out of self-preservation. She really didn't know what to say when her mother plunked a charred brick of meatloaf down with the same dramatic reverence that might have been given to the Holy Grail. As it turned out, though, it was sort of fun. When her mother wasn't acting like she knew it all, because she so totally didn't when it came to cooking, she actually was pretty amusing to hang out with. It was cool, too, for Josie to feel as if she had control over a situation, any situation, even if it happened to be making chocolate pudding or scrubbing its final remains from the bottom of a saucepan. Tonight, they'd made pizza, which Josie had counted as a success, until her mother had tried to slide the pizza out of the oven and it had folded halfway on the coils inside, which meant they had to make grilled cheese as a default dinner. They had salad out of a bag, something her mother couldn't screw up, Josie figured, even if she worked hard at it. But now, thanks to the pudding disaster, there wasn't any dessert. "How did you get to be Julia Child anyway?" her mother asked.
"Julia Child's dead."
"Nigella Lawson, then." Josie shrugged and turned off the water, stripped off the yellow plastic gloves.
"I kinda got sick of soup," she said.
"Didn't I tell you not to turn on the oven when I wasn't home?"
"Yeah, but I didn't listen to you."
Once, when Josie was in fifth grade, the students had had to build a bridge out of popsicle sticks. The idea was to craft a design that could withstand the most pressure. She could remember riding in the car across the Connecticut River and studying the arches and struts and supports of the real bridges, trying her best to copy them. At the end of the unit, two engineers from the Army Corps came in with a machine specially designed to put weight and torque on each bridge to see which child's was the strongest. The parents were invited in for the testing. Josie's mother had been in court, the only mother not present that day. Or so she'd remembered until now, when Josie realized that her mother had been there for the last 10 minutes. She might have missed Josie's bridge test, during which the sticks splintered and groaned and then burst apart in catastrophic failure, but she'd been there in time to help Josie pick up the pieces. The pot was sparkling, silver. The milk carton was half full.
"We could start over," Josie suggested.
When there was no answer, Josie turned around.
"I'd like that,"
her mother answered quietly, but by that time, neither one of them was talking about cooking. There was a knock at the door, and that connection between them, evanescent as a butterfly that lands on your hand, broke.
"Are you expecting someone?"
Josie's mother asked. She wasn't, but she went to answer it anyway. When Josie opened the door, she found the detective who'd interviewed her standing there. "Didn't detectives show up at your door only when you were in serious trouble?"
"Breathe, Josie," she told herself,
and she noticed he was holding a bottle of wine just as her mother came out to see what was going on.
"Oh,"
her mother said. "Patrick."
"Patrick?"
Josie turned and realized her mother was blushing. He held out the bottle of wine.
"Since this seems to be a bone of contention between us."
"You know what?" Josie said, uncomfortable. "I'm just, gonna go study."
She'd leave it to her mother to figure out how she was going to do that, since she had finished her homework before dinner. She flew up the stairs, pounding extra hard with her feet so that she wouldn't hear what her mother was saying. In her room, she turned the music on her CD player up to its loudest level, threw herself onto her bed, and stared up at the ceiling. Josie had a midnight curfew, not that she was using it at all now. But before, the bargain went like this. Matt would get Josie home by midnight. In return, Josie's mother would disappear like smoke the moment they entered the house, retreating upstairs so that she and Matt could fool around in the living room. She had no idea what her mother's rationale for this was, unless it was that it was safer for Josie to be doing this in her own living room than in a car or under the bleachers. She could remember how they'd come together in the dark, their bodies fusing and their silence measured. Realizing that at any moment her mom might come down for a drink of water or an aspirin only made it that much more exciting. At 3 or 4 in the morning, when her eyes were blurry and her chin rubbed raw by beard stubble, Josie would kiss Matt goodnight at the front door. She'd watch his taillights disappear like the glow of a dying cigarette. She'd tiptoe upstairs, past her mother's bedroom,
thinking, "You don't know me at all."
"If I won't let you buy me a drink," Alex said, "then what makes you think I'd take a bottle of wine from you?" Patrick grinned.
"I'm not giving it to you. I'm going to open it, and you might just choose to borrow some."
As he said this, he was walking into the house as if he already knew the way. He stepped into the kitchen, sniffed twice. It still smelled of the ashes of pizza crust and incinerated milk, and began to randomly open and close drawers until he found a corkscrew. Alex folded her arms, not because she was cold, but because she couldn't remember feeling this light inside, as if her body housed a second solar system. She watched Patrick remove two wine glasses from a cabinet and pour.
"To being a civilian," he said, toasting.
The wine was rich and full, like velvet, like autumn. Alex closed her eyes. She would have liked to hold on to this moment, drag it wider and fuller until it covered up so many others that had come before.
"So how is it?" Patrick asked, "being unemployed."
She thought for a moment. "I made a grilled cheese sandwich today without burning the pan."
"I hope you framed it."
"Nah, I left that to the prosecution." She smiled at her own little inside joke and then felt it dissolve on the tails of her thoughts as she imagined Diana Levin's face.
"Do you ever feel guilty?" Alex asked. "Why?"
"Because for a half a second, you've almost forgotten everything that happened." Patrick put down his wine glass.
"Sometimes, when I'm going through the evidence and I see a fingerprint or a photo or a shoe that belonged to one of the kids who died, I take a little more time to look at it. It's crazy, but it seems like someone ought to, so that they're remembered an extra minute or two."
He looked up at her.
"When someone dies, their lives aren't the ones that stop at that moment, you know?"
Alex lifted her glass of wine and drained it.
"Tell me how you found her."
"Who?"
"Josie. That day."
Patrick met her gaze, and Alex knew he was weighing her right to know what her daughter had experienced against his wish to save her from a truth that would cut her to the quick.
"She was in the locker room," he began quietly, "and I thought she was dead, too, because she was covered in blood, face down next to Matt Royston. But then she moved, and..."
His voice broke.
"It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen."
"You know you're a hero, don't you?"
Patrick shook his head. "I'm a coward. The only reason I ran into that building was because if I didn't, I'd have nightmares for the rest of my life."
Alex shivered.
"I have nightmares, and I wasn't even there."
He took away her wine glass and studied her palm as if he were going to read her the line of her life.
"Maybe you should try not sleeping," Patrick said.
His skin smelled of evergreen and spearmint this close. Alex could feel her heart pounding through the tips of her fingers. She imagined he could feel it, too. She didn't know what was going to happen next, what was supposed to happen next, but it would be random, unpredictable, uncomfortable. She was getting ready to push away from him when Patrick's hands anchored her in place.
"Stop being such a judge, Alex," he whispered,
and he kissed her. When feeling came back, in a storm of color and force and sensation, the most you could do was hold on to the person beside you and hope you could weather it. Alex closed her eyes and expected the worst. But it wasn't a bad thing. It was just a different thing. A messier one. A more complicated one. She hesitated, and then she kissed Patrick back, willing to concede that you might have to lose control before you could find what you'd been missing. The month before. When you love someone, There's a pattern to the way you come together. You might not even realize it, but your bodies are choreographed. A touch on the hip, a stroke of the hair, a staccato kiss, breakaway, a longer one, his hand slipping under your shirt. It's a routine, but not in the boring sense of the word. It's just the way you've learned to fit. And it's why, when you've been with one guy for a long time, your teeth do not scrape together when you kiss. You don't bump noses or elbows. Matt and Josie had a pattern. When they started making out, he'd lean in and look at her as if he couldn't possibly see any other part of the world. It was hypnotism, she realized, because after a while she sort of felt that way too. Then he'd kiss her, so slowly that there was hardly pressure on her mouth, until she was the one pushing against him for more. He worked his way down her body, from mouth to neck, from neck to breasts, and then his fingers would do a search-and-rescue mission below the waistband of her jeans. The whole thing lasted about 10 minutes, and then Matt would roll off her and take the condom out of his wallet so they could have sex. Not that Josie minded any of it. If she was going to be honest, she liked the pattern. It felt like a roller coaster, going up that hill, knowing what was coming next on track, and knowing, too, that she couldn't do anything to stop it. They were in her living room, in the dark, with the television on for background noise. Matt had already peeled off her clothes, and now he was leaning over her like a tidal wave, pulling down his boxers. He sprang free and settled between Josie's legs. "Hey," she said, as he tried to push into her. "Aren't you forgetting something?" "Aw, Joe, just once. I don't want there to be anything between us." His words could melt her just as surely as his kiss or his touch. She already knew that by now. She hated that rubbery smell that permeated the air the moment he ripped open the Trojan packet and stayed on his hands until they were finished. And God, did anything feel better than having Matt inside her? Josie shifted just a little, felt her body adjust to him, and her legs trembled. When Josie had gotten her period at 13, her mother hadn't given her the typical heart-to-heart mother-daughter chat. Instead, she handed Josie a book on probability and statistics. "Every time you have sex, you can get pregnant or you cannot get pregnant," her mother said. "That's 50-50. So don't fool yourself into thinking that if you only do it once without protection, the odds are in your favor." Josie pushed at Matt. "I don't think we should do this," she whispered. "Have sex? Have sex without, you know, anything." He was disappointed. Josie could tell by the way his face froze for just a moment. But he pulled out and fished for his wallet, found a condom. Josie took it out of his hand, tore open the package, helped him put it on. "One day," she began, and then he kissed her, and Josie forgot what she was going to say. Lacey had started spreading corn on the lawn back in November to help the deer through the winter. There were plenty of locals who frowned upon artificially giving the deer a helping hand during the winter, mostly the same people whose gardens were wrecked by those surviving deer in the summer. But for Lacey, there was karma involved. As long as Lewis insisted on hunting, she was going to do what little she could to cancel out his actions. She put on her heavy boots. There was still enough snow on the ground to merit it, although it had gotten warm enough for the sap to start flowing, which meant that at least in theory, spring was coming. As soon as Lacey walked outside, she could smell the maple syrup refining in the neighbor's sugar house, like candy crystals in the air. She carried the bucket of feed corn to the swing set in the backyard, a wooden structure that the boys had played on when they were small, and that Lewis had never quite gotten around to dismantling. "Hey, Mom." Lacey turned to find Peter standing nearby, his hands dug deep into the pockets of his jeans. He was wearing a T-shirt and a down vest, and she imagined he had to be freezing.
Hi, sweetie, she said. What's going on?
She could probably count on one hand the number of times Peter had come out of his room lately, much less outside. It was part of puberty, she knew, for adolescents to hole up in burrows and do whatever it was they did behind closed doors. In Peter's case, it involved the computer. He was online constantly, not for web surfing as much as programming, and how could she fault that kind of passion?
Nothing. What are you doing?
Same thing I've done all winter.
Really?
She looked up at him. Against the beauty of the brisk outdoors, Peter seemed wildly out of place. His features were too delicate to match the craggy line of mountains in the backdrop behind him. His skin seemed nearly as white as the snow. He didn't fit, and Lacey realized that most of the time when she saw Peter somewhere, she could make the same observation.
Here, Lacey said, handing him the bucket. Help.
Peter took the bucket and began to toss handfuls of corn on the ground.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Is it true that you were the one who asked out Dad?
Lacey grinned.
Well, if I hadn't, I would have probably had to wait around forever. Your father is many things, but perceptive isn't one of them.
She had met Lewis at a pro-choice rally. Although Lacey would be the first to tell you that there was no greater gift than having a baby, she was a realist. She'd sent home enough mothers who were too young or too poor or too overburdened to know that the odds of that child having a good life were slim. She had gone with a friend to march at the State House in Concord and stood on the steps with a sisterhood of women who held up signs. I'm pro-choice and I vote. Against abortion? Don't have one. She had looked around the crowd that day and realized that there was one lone man, well-dressed in a suit and tie, right in the thick of the protesters. Lacey had been fascinated by him. As a protester, he was completely cast against type.
Wow,
Lacey had said, working her way toward him.
What a day.
Tell me about it.
Have you ever been here before?
Lacey had asked.
My first time,
Lewis said.
Mine too.
They had gotten separated as a new influx of marchers came up the stone steps. A paper had blown off the stack that Lewis was carrying, but by the time Lacey could grab it, he'd been swallowed by the crowd. It was the cover page to something bigger, she knew by the staple holes at the top, and it had a title that nearly put her to sleep. The Allocation of Public Education Resources in New Hampshire, a Critical Analysis. But there was also an author's name. Lewis Houghton, Sterling College Department of Economics. When she called to tell Lewis that she had his paper, he said that he didn't need it. He could print out another copy.
Yes,
Lacey had said, but I have to bring this one back to you.
Why?
So you can explain it to me over dinner. It wasn't until they'd gone out for sushi that Lacey learned the reason Lewis had been at the State House had nothing to do with attending a pro-choice rally, but only because he had a scheduled appointment with the governor.
But how did you tell him?
Peter asked.
That you liked him, you know, like that.
As I recall, I grabbed him after our third date and kissed him. Then again, that may have been to shut him up because he was going on and on about free trade. She glanced back over her shoulder, and suddenly the questions all made sense.
Peter,
she said, a smile breaking over her.
Is there someone you like?
Peter didn't even have to answer. His face turned crimson.
Do I get to know her name?
No,
Peter said emphatically.
Well, it doesn't matter.
She looped her arm through Peter's.
Gosh, I envy you. There's nothing that compares to those first few months when all you can think of is each other. I mean, love in any form is pretty fabulous, but falling in love. Well,
it's not like that, Peter said. I mean, it's kind of one-sided.
I bet she's just as nervous as you are.
He grimaced.
Mom, she barely even registers my existence. I don't hang out with the kind of people she hangs out with.
Lacey looked at her son.
Well, she said, then your first order of business is to change that.
How?
Find ways to connect with her, maybe in places where you know her friends won't be around, and try to show her the side of you that she doesn't normally see.
Like what?
The inside.
Lacey tapped Peter's chest.
If you tell her how you feel, I think you might be surprised at the reaction.
Peter ducked his head and kicked at a hummock of snow. Then he glanced up at her shyly.
Really?
Lacey nodded.
It worked for me.
Okay, Peter said.
Thanks.
She watched him trudge back up the hill to the house, and then she turned her attention back to the deer. Lacey would have to feed them until the snow melted. Once you started taking care of them, you had to follow through, or they just wouldn't make it. They were on the floor of the living room, and they were nearly naked. Josie could taste beer on Matt's breath, but she must have tasted like that, too. They'd both drunk a few at Drew's. Not enough to get wasted, just buzzed. Enough so that Matt's hand seemed to be all over her at once, so that his skin set fire to hers. She'd been floating along pleasantly in a haze of the familiar. Yes, Matt had kissed her. One short one, then a longer, hungry kiss, as his hand worked open the clasp on her bra. She lay lazy, spread beneath him like a feast as he pulled off her jeans. But then, instead of doing what usually came next, Matt reared over her again. He kissed her so hard that it hurt.
"Oof,"
she said, pushing at him.
"Relax,"
Matt murmured, and then he sank his teeth into her shoulder. He pinned her hands over her head and ground his hips against hers. She could feel his erection, hot against her stomach. It wasn't the way it normally was, but Josie had to admit that it was exciting. She couldn't remember ever feeling so heavy, as if her heart were beating between her legs. She clawed at Matt's back to bring him closer.
"Yeah," he groaned, and he pushed her thighs apart.
And then suddenly, Matt was inside her, pumping so hard that she scooted backward on the carpet, burning the backs of her legs.
"Wait,"
Josie said, trying to roll away beneath him, but he clamped his hand over her mouth and drove harder and harder until Josie felt him come. Semen, sticky and hot, pooled on the carpet beneath her. Matt framed her face with his hands.
"Jesus, Josie," he whispered,
and she realized that he was in tears.
"I love you so goddamn much."
Josie turned her face away.
"I love you too."
She lay in his arms for 10 minutes and then said she was tired and needed to go to sleep. After she kissed Matt goodbye at the front door, she went into the kitchen and took the rug cleaner out from underneath the sink. She scrubbed it into the wet spot on the carpet, prayed it wouldn't leave a stain. Peter highlighted the text on his computer screen and deleted it. Although he thought it would be pretty cool to open an email and automatically have an I love you message written over and over on the screen, he could see where someone else, someone who didn't give a crap about C++, would think it was just downright strange. He'd decided on an email because that way, if she blew him off, he could suffer the embarrassment in private. The problem was, his mother had said to show what was inside him, and he wasn't very good when it came to words. He thought about how sometimes, when he saw her, it was just a part of her, her arm resting on the passenger window of the car, her hair blowing out its window. He thought about how many times he'd fantasized about being the one at the wheel.
"My journey was pointless," he wrote,
"until I took a Y-O-U turn." Groaning, Peter deleted that too. It made him sound like a Hallmark card writer, or even worse,
one that Hallmark wouldn't even hire. He thought about what he wished he could say to her, if he had the guts, and poised his hands over the keyboard. I know you don't think of me, and you certainly would never picture us together. But probably peanut butter was just peanut butter for a long time, before someone ever thought of pairing it up with jelly. And there was salt, but it started to taste better when there was pepper. And what's the point of butter without bread? Why are all these examples foods? Anyway, by myself, I'm nothing special. But with you, I think I could be. He agonized about the ending. Your friend, Peter Houghton. Well, technically that wasn't true. Sincerely, Peter Houghton. That was true, but it was still sort of lame. Of course, there was the obvious. Love, Peter Houghton. He typed it in, read it over once, and then, before he could stop himself, he pushed the enter button and sent his heart across the Ethernet to Josie Cormier. Courtney Ignacio was so freaking bored. Josie was her friend and all, but there was, like, nothing to do. They'd already watched 3 Paul Walker movies on DVD, checked the Lost website for the bio on the hot guy who played Sawyer, and read all the Cosmos that hadn't been recycled, but there was no HBO, nothing chocolate in the fridge, and no party at Sterling College to sneak into. This was Courtney's second night at the Cormier household, thanks to her brainiac older brother, who had dragged her parents on a whirlwind tour of Ivy League colleges on the East Coast. Courtney plopped a stuffed hippo on her stomach and frowned into its button eyes. She'd already tried to get details out of Josie last night about Matt. Important things, like how big a dick he had and if he had a clue how to use it. But Josie had gone all Hillary Duff on her and acted like she'd never heard the word sex before. Josie was in the bathroom taking a shower. Courtney could still hear the water running. She rolled to her side and scrutinized a framed photograph of Josie and Matt. It would have been easy to hate Josie, because Matt was the uber-boyfriend, always glancing around at a party to make sure he hadn't gotten too far away from Josie, calling her up to say goodnight, even when he'd just dropped her off a half hour before. Yes, Courtney had been privy to a display of that very thing just last night. Unlike most of the guys on the hockey team, several of whom Courtney had dated, Matt honestly seemed to prefer Josie's company to anyone else's. But there was something about Josie that kept Courtney from being jealous. It was the way her expression slipped every now and then, like a colored contact lens, so you could see what was actually underneath. Josie might have been one half of Sterling High School's most faithful couple, but it almost seemed like the biggest reason she clung to that label was because that was the only reason she knew who she was. "You've got mail." The automaton on Josie's computer spoke. Until then, Courtney hadn't realized that they'd left the computer running, much less online. She settled down at the desk, wiggling the mouse so that the screen came back into focus. Maybe Matt was writing some kind of cyber porn. It would be fun to screw around with him a little and pretend that she was Josie. The return address, though, wasn't one that Courtney recognized. She and Josie, after all, had nearly identical buddy lists. There was no subject. Courtney clicked on the link, assuming it was some kind of junk mail. "Enlarge your penis in 30 days. Refinance your home. Real deals on printer ribbon cartridges." The email opened, and Courtney started to read. "Oh, my God," she murmured. "This is too fucking good." She swiped the body of the email and forwarded it to rightwing90@yahoo.com. "Drew," she typed, "spam this out to the whole wide world." The door to the bathroom opened, and Josie came back into the bedroom wearing a bathrobe, a towel wrapped around her head. Courtney closed the server window. "Goodbye," the automaton said. "What's up?" Josie asked.
Courtney turned around in the chair, smiling.
Just checking my mail, she said.
Josie couldn't sleep. Her mind was tumbling like a spring stream. This was exactly the sort of problem she wished she could talk about with someone. But who?